Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. I'm Glenn Moberg, and today on Route 51, we look back at an important part of the economic history of North Central Wisconsin. It's also a rags-to-riches human interest story of a family of brothers that used their rural backwoods skills to create a family fortune and to make Merrill the unlikely capital of the world fur industry. The Fromm brothers started with nothing on their Hamburg farm at the turn of the last century, but they had a dream of breeding and raising rare silver foxes. With no money and experiencing setback after setback, well, they not only realized their dream, but they also helped create Central Wisconsin's ginseng cultivation industry. And they developed a canine distemper vaccine that is still in use today. At its height, Fromm Brothers furs were sold on the market for millions of dollars. They were featured at the Chicago World's Fair in the 1930s. They were worn by Jackie Kennedy, Rita Hayworth, and the Vanderbilts. And their operation was personally visited by New York Mayor Fiorella LaGuardia, architect Frank Lloyd Wright, and apparently even Albert Einstein. Our guest today, Gary Mason, who with his son, John, has turned the old Fromm Brothers complex into a convention center and museum called the Foxtail and Silver Fox Retreat. Also joining us, Stan Pufall. He's a fox rancher and owner of the old Walter Fromm House. And as always, we want to hear from you. If you remember the Fromm Brothers and their fur operation, if you worked for them or you knew somebody who did, if you remember them or their generosity to Central Wisconsin, this show always works better when you're a part of it. So give us a call at 261-6371. That's 261-6371 if you're in the greater Wausau area or anywhere you're listening at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Gary and Stan, thanks so much for being with us today. And this is really an amazing story. You gave a presentation, Gary, at Rotary on Monday. And I had known something about the Fromm brothers, but I had no idea of the incredible story behind that operation.
Yes, it's a fantastic story. And what we're trying to do now is to promote it and keep it alive. So many times things happen, and as time goes on, they fade away. And we're trying to keep that alive and then have people come out for retreats and sponsor just events out there.
Well, tell us about the Foxtail and the Silver Fox Retreat. This is in rural Hamburg, yes, which is a little community southwest of Merrill.
Yes, it's 18 miles north of Wausau and 18 miles south of Merrill. And what we've done is taken some of the 25 buildings that are out there and turned them into a retreat center to where you can have small corporate retreats out there. You can have banquets out there, family reunions. We have wireless internet out there. We do have horse rides out there. And then a crowning jewel on this is the clubhouse. That has a four-lane Brunswick bowling alley in it. But the problem you have, you've got to set your own pins.
No kidding.
Yes.
You know, that sounds like a great time.
It is.
Especially for people who want to re-experience what Central Wisconsin used to be like back at the turn of the last century, because it was certainly lacked a lot of the conveniences and amenities that we have today.
Yes, that's true. We do offer sleigh rides, too, in the winter, which is a very important thing. And we have campfires out there. And
just... Now, this clubhouse, are you turning that into a museum?
We're turning it into a museum, and it also functions as a meeting center. It has two stone fireplaces, the bowling alley, a nice refreshment area, the bar. Yes, we have it... for a museum, a lot of artifacts is in there.
Well, let's get the shameless self-promotion out of the way right away. If people want to get in touch with you, how can they do that?
They can do that at our, they can call us at 539-2634, or they can call, look at the website at Foxtail, F-O-X-T-A-L-E. org.
Not the tail like the rear end of the fox, but the tail like
That's
the
right.
story behind
the, story,
the
yes.
Fromm brothers, and it is quite a tale. How many buildings are out there right now, and when were they built, and what condition are they in today?
There's approximately 25 buildings out there. All of them have good roofs. We have they've been pretty well restored by the Duane and Sarah Vetter. During the mid-90s, they turned it into a home for troubled boys. And so they fixed up the roofs and did a lot of interior work on it. So they're in really good shape. There's a few things. One building does not have a good roof. We have to work on that. Mm-hmm. But it's overall in good shape.
And when were these buildings actually constructed?
The first one was a ginseng house, was done in 1915. And then probably in 1934, 35 was the last buildings. And some of them, like the boarding house, is 7,900 square feet. That was added on to, it was built in 1922, but added on to over the years.
So I imagine we've got big honking pieces of timber involved in some of these buildings.
Yes, the clubhouse is about a 6,000 square foot building made out of hardwood logs with the bark still on inside.
No kidding.
Yes, and it has a very rustic appearance inside, and it's just a warm feeling when you go in there, especially when the fireplaces are going.
Stan Pufall, you live in the old Walter Fromm house. What's it like?
Well, the house was constructed during 1927 and 28, and that was that happened to be also the first year that they received a check from the fur industry for $1,330,000.
That was real money back then.
That was real money. Yes. The house that Walter built kind of ended up being the showplace of the Fromm brothers as far as their homes went. It was the show-off, I suppose, house. And interestingly enough, it really wasn't Walter Fromm's character, though.
In what sense?
He was a very simple. He was a horticulturalist. He headed up the ginseng portion of the business, and he would just as soon be in the garden than in a fancy house, and that was his preference. And all the other properties that he owned besides that house was really quite simple.
All of the Fromm brothers, the four main ones who were involved in starting this business, they all had their own personality quirks.
Yes, and they all had their own little facet of the business. Like Henry was pretty much with the Fox and later on with the Mink. John was with Fox also. Walter was with ginseng. And Ed was the businessman.
And Henry was like 9 years old when he started getting involved in it?
He was 8 years old when he read a lot of magazines and decided, said to his brothers, he says, well, why don't we raise Fox? And he had never seen one. They had seen pictures of them in magazines. But he said that to the oldest one was 12, and that was Ed. And so they decided to go ahead with this operation.
Well, it's quite a history. And if you can imagine an 8-year-old brother talking to his older brothers who were like 11, 12, and in their later teens,
yes,
into coming up with this wild dream of cultivating silver foxes, breeding them, and making a fortune, and then with no money to actually do it.
Yes, no money. They had a promotion, one fence company that was supplying fences to the people. They had a promotion that if you send in a picture of fox, they would judge them. And they won the prize. They won $50 or something. And that's where they got the money for their fencing.
One of the brothers was a photographer.
That could be. That I'm not sure. Yes.
But they judged that picture, and they were able to get the $50. And
yes,
$50. They went from there.
Yes.
At their peak, the Fromm Brothers operation, again, we're talking about this in rural Hamburg, which is still pretty rural today.
Yes.
At their peak, how big was this operation?
They had 11,000 acres of land up here and 6,000 acres near Thienesville, Mequon, and Grafton. They would produce approximately 30,000 fox pelts a year and approximately 30,000 mink pelts a year. And they were producing ginseng at peak times about 200 acres a year. And a lot of times they would go 5, 6, and even 7 years on the growth. Most people do 4 years right now.
How much money were they pulling in every year at their peak?
Well, at their peak, one judgment that I use is we have their personal income tax records from 1928. The company paid for everything but food and clothing for the brothers. Each brother earned $72,000. That is equivalent to $1.3 to $1.5 in today's dollars. The actual volume, dollar volume, I don't know what that is.
And they actually ended up creating a fur manufacturing business in the city of Merrill. Tell us about that.
Yes, they had an operation in New York making fur coats, but they got into a little squabble with the union out there, so they decided they would make them here in Merrill. They kept the factory in New York also. They weren't trying to break the union, but they started making them in Merrill, which is the old tech school building right now. And, yes, they were self-sufficient in that way.
And when did the entire operation stop producing furs?
The last pelting was 1985. The third generation had taken over, and the market for fur had changed. So things were changing then. And
How much of this had to do with the anti-fur movement, PETA, and the changing consciousness in this country at that point in time?
I think that had a contributing factor to it. It was kind of towards the end of the market anyway for Fox, because Fox were falling out of fashion, where mink were more sleek and made the lady look sleeker. And then PETA did, you know, put a stop to it. It's affecting Medford right now, too.
Were they ever the target of any activities by PETA or any anti-fur organizations? We heard some stories of other operations where they actually opened the cages and let the minks out.
In Medford they did that. I am not aware of anything. I know they were concerned about Dillinger going up to Little Bohemia and things like that because they had a lot of money there. And so that was a major concern for them.
They were concerned about the gangsters during the 20s. Well, and Hamburg is right on the route, isn't
That's
it?
That's right. Yes.
Stan, tell me how you feel about being involved in all of this history, actually living part of the history, and you're a fur rancher too.
Yes. It's quite an honor to live there, and you know, if walls could talk, they definitely would tell a lot of stories, but I hear a lot of stories. Everybody that's worked there or knows of it, they really enjoy sharing. So it's been a lot of fun, and being a fur rancher, the Fromm brothers certainly are the most prolific and well-known, and even today in the world, people still know them.
How many animals do you raise?
Oh, 100 to 200. We specialize in very specialized colors.
Mm-hmm.
That, in fact, a couple of them were developed by Fromm Brothers in the 50s and 60s.
Are these mink that you're talking about?
No, they're foxes.
They're foxes, okay.
Yeah, there's one color that Fromm Brothers developed in the 50s. Actually, they started in the 40s, and it took them 35 years to get the color straightened out. And it's called a Fromm Brown, and it's actually got a scientific code.
A genetic code that identifies those?
Yeah, and it begins with FRBR, which is Fromm Brown. So if you start out with a red fox and a silver fox, it takes approximately about 30 years of breeding to end up with one Fromm Brown with no mistakes. So it's not easy to replicate.
And these backwoodsmen who basically, had a limited formal education, they ended up learning about genetics. They ended up learning about the science of ginseng. They ended up learning about the science of breeding animals just by observation and trial and error.
That's right. A lot of errors. And the canine distemper vaccine, they would lose a third of their fox some years because a raccoon spreads the disease, the germs, and they would get in the cages. And so they would lose, like I said, a third. And so they hired Dr. Green from University of Minnesota, and he spent, I believe, about $1 million in a little over a year, sometime in the 20s, and he developed the canine distemper vaccine that is still used worldwide today. Pandas even get it, because pandas will have cages and the coons will get in there. So.
No kidding. Gary Mason, he is the owner and the operator of a convention center and museum called the Foxtail and Silver Fox Retreat. We've also got Stan Pufall with us. He's a fox rancher and owner of the old Walter Fromm House. We are looking back in history, folks, to the days when Merrill, Wisconsin was the center of the worldwide fur industry, and this incredible story of these four brothers, these backwoods brothers, who when one was just 8 years old and the others were in their teens, had a dream of becoming fox breeders, and somehow they were able to turn that into reality. I know a lot of you who are listening knew the Fromm brothers. Some of you probably had friends or relatives who either worked for the fur business in Merrill or worked for some of their other operations. We'd love to hear from you if we can just elaborate on this local history. I think it would be wonderful. Our phone number, 2616371. That's 2616371 if you're in the Wausau area, or 1-800-780-9742 anywhere you're listening. That's 1-800-780-9742. I'm Glenn Mobrick. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network.
Support for WPR comes from UMR, a United Healthcare company providing employee benefits administration, integrated health management, and pharmacy benefits administration for self-funded employers throughout the U.S. More about UMR at umr.com.
For more information about business sponsorships, call Rick Ryer at 1-800-749-3906.
Those phone numbers again, 2616371, 1-800-780-9742. We're talking about the Fromm Brothers Fur Farm in rural Merrill, in the Hamburg area, and the fact that they were able to turn Merrill, Wisconsin into the center of the world fur industry and really revolutionize in many ways the science of ginseng cultivation and develop a vaccine to cure canine distemper. Our guests again, Gary Mason and Stan Pufall. Gary, let's talk about ginseng. This is something that the brothers got into really because they wanted to find a way to raise money for acquiring foxes.
Yes, that's correct. There was a neighbor that had tried to raise ginseng, but they couldn't do it. But the brothers started out collecting wild ginseng. Again, everybody was doing it, so they couldn't get enough of it. And so they decided they were going to raise it. Okay. The father decided that they should not be in this foolish thing, fox, ginseng, or anything like this. So he gave them a piece of land that they could do their ginseng on. But that land happened to be the depository of all the rocks from the fields that they were clearing to raise hops for the breweries.
Oh, gee, thanks, Dad.
Yes, thanks, Dad. He was really real encouragement for them. But they persisted. They raised crops. They got into the Ginseng Association. And when you get into...
So let's go back to this point. These young boys in their teens wanted to raise ginseng, which at the time was kind of an exotic crop, and they did it by digging the wild roots, which were growing in the woods in back of their home, and they say, Dad, we really want to do this, and Dad says, you can't have the land?
That's right, yes. You can't have the land. This is foolish. Again, be farmers. Don't fool with the crops like that. But they persisted. What they did is...
And he made them clear... rocks?
Oh, yes. He made them clear. When you farm a first time, a virgin area, you clear the timber, and then you have to clear the rocks that are there. And they had sleds that they would load up with rocks and pull over into an area that wasn't good for farming.
So he piled all the rocks onto this land, and they were all piled up on this land, and then he made his sons move them a second time?
Yes.
So they could grow ginseng there?
If they wanted to grow ginseng, they had to move them a second time, yes.
It's an amazing story of perseverance with these kids.
It is, yes.
And they suffered a lot of setbacks with ginseng because it was something that nobody was doing at the time, really.
Yes.
They had to learn it from scratch, again, using their backwoods skills.
Yes, their farm skills that they had learned raising crops for them.
Well, backwoods, too, because that's where they
found
ginseng plants.
Right into the forest.
And they had to construct the awnings?
Yes, they had
the arbors.
The arbors for it. They'd get scraps of wood from various places, and they would make the arbors. Then they would have to take those down in the winter, too, because they would break.
And I read in this book, and I didn't even mention that there's a book that's been re-released, so we need to talk about that. It was written by Catherine Pinkerton back in 1947.
Yes.
And it has just been re-released. It's called Bright with Silver, and it's been reissued by the Birch Lake Press of Wausau. You can get copies of it at Yankee Books in downtown Wausau. But it details the entire story.
Yes.
And with some photos in it, and talks about the ginseng operation. They were the first ones to build the flat, flat shelters that we see all over central Wisconsin.
Yes, they were. Yes, and they.
Now, why was that? Why would they?
That simulates the woods. That would simulate, you know, as if it was growing in the forest. You can't grow ginseng in an open field. It needs that shade from a natural, like a forest, or simulate it.
So with their backwoods skills, they were able to figure out exactly what they needed to do, what shelters they needed to construct in order to make ginseng succeed.
That is correct, yes. Yes, it's a feat.
And they had setbacks at first.
Oh, they had crop failures. They had just innumerable things that would go wrong. The blight didn't hit them till later on. It would hit other people that were trying it, but somehow they avoided the blight for the longest time.
Well, hold that thought. We have so much history that we're going to run out of time by the time we hit 6 o'clock, but we do have to take a break right now for news. 261-6371 or 1-800-780-9742 if you'd like to join the conversation. Gary and Edgar, hang on. We'll get to you right after the news break.
Oh, Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of the Wisconsin Educational Communications Board and the University of Wisconsin Extension, with additional financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from listeners through the Wisconsin Public Radio Association.
We're back on Route 51 Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network. I'm Glenn Moberg, and we are taking a trip down memory lane looking at the economic history of central Wisconsin, going back to the days when Merrill, and particularly the little hamlet of Hamburg, southwest of Merrill, was the center of the world fur industry. We're talking about the Fromm Brothers Farm with Gary Mason, who is taking the old complex and turning it into a convention center and a museum called the Fox Tail and Silver Fox Retreat. Also with us, Stan Pufall, who is a fox rancher and also living in one of the buildings on that old complex, the old Walter Fromm House. We've got a lot of stories about the days when men were men, and these Fromm brothers turned a dream into a fantastic reality using really little more than their own perseverance and their backwoods skills and the skills they learned as rural farmers in the Hamburg area. We would love to hear from you, 261-6371 or 1-800-780-9742. And we are joined by another guest, Robert Check, who, Robert, as I understand it, you used to work for the Fromm Brothers at one point.
Yes, I started working there when I was 16 years old, and that was 1949. And my dad worked there also from a teenager, and he worked for the Fromm Brothers for about 50 years, all his life. And at the time when I started, I was working during high school vacation in the summer, and my two brothers were there too, and I and my two brothers and my dad would go there at 6:30 in the morning and have breakfast at the boarding house, and from there on we'd go to our jobs.
What kinds of things did you do there?
Well, I was in summers I was usually working with John, and that was with the grading and the vaccinating of the foxes. And at one time, and for 2 years, two different years after high school, I worked. And then I was working with the foxes, and one of my jobs were to tattoo the ears of the foxes. And In one ear, you tattoo the pedigree and the year they were born and the pen where they were raised. So you could go back, when they were even on the auction, you could still go back to that pelt where it was born and what year and what pedigree it had.
It was quite an operation. How important was that, do you think, Robert, to the economy of the Merrill area?
Oh, it was very important. It was. We were so grateful to be able to get part-time jobs at times and work and get some money for our education. And it was just one of those things that you couldn't imagine them not being there when we were needed work.
How did you feel when they finally closed the operation down in 1985?
It was a sad thing. It's I still drive past some of the empty Fox pens there, and it brings back a lot of memories. So much history in that in the Brum Brothers Enterprise, and it's kind of a sad feeling.
Gary, have you got anything to add to this?
Just a sad feeling, and what we're trying to do is help the people overcome that sad feeling by preserving their history. That's one of the things we enjoy. We have people coming up to us and thanking us for preserving that history, and that's very rewarding, and it needs to be preserved.
And we're talking to Gary Mason, who again is the owner of the Foxtail and Silver Fox Retreat, this convention center and museum at the old Fromm Brothers Complex. Let's go to a different Gary. This is Gary in Edgar. Gary, you're on Route 51, and I see on my computer it tells me that you knew the Fromms.
Yes, my grandparents were John and Eleanor Vugadis, and they lived just north of Marathon, town of River Falls, and they had Silver Fox also. I think they had like four or six of them, but they were social friends with the Fromms. And Jim Lawrence and Howard Kluder wrote this book, Woodlot to Ballot Box, The History of Marathon County. And so after I bought that book, I took it over by my grandmother and was showing her different things about it. And I showed her the part in the book which talked about the Fromm brothers.
No, that's a Jim Lawrence, who's a professor at UW-Marathon County,
yes.
The historian.
Yep. Yeah, the very good professor at the UW. And when she saw that, she said, oh, the Fromm boys. Well, my grandmother was born in like 1890-something, you know. And she talked about a time when her and my grandfather went up to one of their nice big mansion houses. And here in the house, they had this beautiful top-of-the-line piano. And nobody knew how to play it. They just bought it because it looked so nice, and they thought eventually, hopefully, somebody could play. Well, my grandmother was a school teacher. She could play piano, and she said that night she played for about 2 hours. And they sat around and sang and listened to her play piano, and they were just so happy to have that beautiful instrument used.
Now, I have heard, and it's in this book, Bright with Silver, a book written in 1947 by Catherine Pinkerton. It's been reissued. But in the book, they described the Fromm boys as being musicians, but they played the violin by and large, and I think one of them played the clarinet. So maybe they had a little orchestra going there with your grandma.
Yeah, that's what, anyway, she said to me, when she came, and then she was complimenting them on how fine of a piano they had. They said, oh, it's just so beautiful, but none of us really play it. And they asked her if she could play, and she said, sure. And she said they played for about 2 hours, and just she said it was a great time, you know.
Gary, thanks so much for the phone call. We really appreciate it. And let's talk about the Fromm brothers and the fact that they managed to find time, Gary Mason, for music in their lives.
Yes, they did. They sent one of their nephews to Harvard to learn business, and he started a band once he got back. It was called Johnny and the Foxes, and he would go around playing around the area quite a bit. And later on, when Ed got a little older, he did actually learn to play the piano. So he was quite an accomplished pianist, and he was in the U.S. Army band at one time. That's one of the only Fromms that was in the service.
Let's get back to the ginseng business. And Robert Check, while you were working on the farm, was the ginseng business still going on at the time?
Yes, it was. I worked very little in the ginseng. I was mainly with the mink and the fox.
And they had to find a way to make up for the lack of manpower as we headed into the Second World War, when picking ginseng at the time was a very labor intensive business, and they came up with a way of using an old potato picker and changing it around so that it could be used for ginseng production.
Yes, that's correct. Bob, do you recall that?
Yes, I very well. Yeah, because I worked when in the busy seasons they took as many people from different areas to do the work out in the ginseng.
And this this potato picker had to be changed for ginseng cultivation.
Yes,
and they had a guy. Kleinschmidt, I think, was his name, Herbert Kleinschmidt, who worked with Walter Fromm, and they converted this double potato digger into a ginseng harvester, and it's something that revolutionized the ginseng production industry.
Yes, still used worldwide today in the ginseng industry.
What were the Fromm brothers like? Robert, you remember them, don't you?
Yes, very well.
What were they like?
Well, I worked mainly for John, and he was a quiet individual, but he listened more than he talked. and I worked for Henry also, and in fact I worked for Henry with his mink up at Boulder Junction for 1 year, and it was very, very interesting.
Very much hard workers, the whole family is what I've been told.
Well, I was amazed at the story of perseverance, and I guess you have to go back to what the area was like back at the turn of the last century, back in the early part of the 1900s, before everybody had cars, before the roads were paved. When they were first trying to acquire foxes, the story is that they walked 22 miles to Marathon City in order to catch a train to Polar to meet with a farmer who had a silver fox for sale. And I guess during the course of that, they were so disappointed that they weren't able to get the farmer to part with his valuable animal at a price they could afford that, I guess out of penance, they walked the entire 62 miles from Polar back to Hamburg, walked it, and they were back in time to do their morning milking chores.
They persevered over a lot of obstacles like that, yes.
And as you were saying, they had to be concerned about security in those early days, too.
Yes, they had guards that patrol the area. We actually have required one of the shotguns the guards would carry. But, yes, they were concerned about people stealing the fox. Even, you know, like we talked earlier about the mafia coming through and things like that.
The mob, John Dillinger and Al Capone heading up north, they were worried about, I guess they had valuable foxes, and sometimes
yes.
They had some money.
Some money there, too, yes.
Now, even when they were young, they jealously guarded those ginseng crops and the first fox cages that they had.
Yes, the ginseng, they joined a ginseng association, and they had a round table thing. You were president of it, or you were very involved, and you rotated visiting everybody's ginseng yards. And when it came to the Fromms, they backed out of the organization. They did not want anybody coming onto their property to see their ginseng operation.
What were they worried about?
Well, they had little things that they had tried and failed at and then did succeed at, that they didn't want other people to succeed at.
Yeah, other people were still failing.
That's correct, yes.
And they had to learn all about genetics in order to breed these foxes.
Yes, they had to just trial and error. You mix this female with a male, and pretty soon you kind of figured out what would produce what color, and it's just trial and error. We do have all their breeding records there yet, but it doesn't mean anything now, but we do have them.
Stan, as a fox rancher, comment about the aspect of these young boys learning pretty much from scratch how to breed these animals.
Well, it's definitely quite a feat because, you know, in the days when they got their first fox, when they bought the three fox from Prince Edward Island for $6,000 in the teens.
And again, that's real money back then.
Yeah, that's real money. You know, they were the fox were nearly black, and that was really the preference at the time because that's all anybody knew. When a silver fox, it's a dominant gene mutation, you know, in the wild from a red, but they're mostly black with a little bit of silver, and to take that fox and eventually turn it into mostly silver with a little bit of black. Is interesting, especially when you've never done it.
And there is a picture in this book that was written by Catherine Pinkerton showing a series of pelts starting in 1910, going from a dark black, and then the black is flecked with a little bit of silver, and by the time you get to the last pelt, it's like a bright silver color.
Yes, the progression.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. Did they have to create a market for these silver pelts, or did the market already exist?
No, they had to create the market. Like Stan said, the market was for black fox, but Ed decided to, or the brothers decided that they would send Ed to Paris. Ed went to Paris with some pelts and a coat, and they went to the designers over there, and he showed the designers what he had, and they kind of turned up their nose.
What year was this?
Oh, that I'm not positive on.
Back in the 30s?
Back in the, I would say the late 20s.
Late 20s,
somewhere
okay.
In there. And he went over there, and they turned up their nose at it. So what he did is came back and started advertising in Vogue magazine, Women's Wear Daily, and the market immediately switched to bright silver. And like we've talked about, it's a long process to catch up to get all silver fox. So they had the market for the longest time because of that.
Tell me about that big year when they sold their pelts for $1.3 million. They knew that they had something.
They knew finally. They had something, yes. And a little side note on that, they sold one pelt, and I'm not sure on the year, brought in $2,100. Marshall Fields and another company had an advertising campaign built around that pelt. So they wanted it, and that's what drove up the price. But, that's...
Unbelievable.
Yes.
And you ended up having huge auctions at the Hamburg facility that would attract people and traders from around the world. What was that like?
Well, what they did is, they got to be the largest in the industry, and they decided, well, we should bring the people here to see the operation. And all these buyers are New York people. They've never been in the woods, so they decided to set up the auction, and the auction houses did not like that too well out east, but they persevered and went ahead with it. 5 days before the auction, they had a huge snowfall before the buyers were to come. And then right after a huge snowfall, you have the temperature plummet. That was the day the buyers were to come. And they were just nervous. They had this whole setup there, pelts and just a fancy thing. They were staying at the Hotel Wausau or the Landmark building now. The buyers got there. They loved it. They had never seen anything like this. And we have a lot of pictures out there that of the buyers all dressed up as woodsmen. So
uh-huh.
they could go back and tell their friends that they were out in the woods.
Mayor LaGuardia of New York City went to one of these auctions in rural Hamburg.
He was at one of the auctions, and then he came there during the summer, too, because he wanted to see where all these pelts were coming from, were being sent to New York to be displayed or made into coats.
Frank Lloyd Wright went to one of the auctions?
Frank Lloyd Wright, I don't believe auctioned, but he came there to build a home for Ed. The original family home burnt down, and Ed wanted a new home, and Frank Lloyd Wright came to do it. And
is that home still standing?
Yes, but Frank didn't design it.
Oh, okay.
There was a...
So he showed up and didn't get the job, huh?
He didn't get the job because Ed thought it should be...
So the Fromm brothers were very picky.
They were very
picky.
Frank
Lloyd Wright wasn't good enough.
That's right. He wanted to build it in a different location than Ed wanted to. And so Ed they asked, parted their way.
Ed asked him to leave.
Ed asked him to leave, yes.
Did he really?
Yes.
And rumor has it Albert Einstein was actually at one of the auctions.
Yes, we have. When you came to the auction, there were buyers that had badges, press had badges, and going through these badges, we found a badge for Albert Einstein. So it's a very good possibility he was here.
Robert Check, as somebody who worked on the farm, were you there when any of those auctions took place, or did you work after that?
Yes, I was at. I worked at one of their last auctions, and I think it was in 1952 or 53. I'm not quite sure.
And what was that like?
Well, it was a very exciting time. The buyers would come, and as one of my jobs was to bring bundles of pelts to an individual buyer that would check them out in a catalog. He would grade them out, and before the auction started, they had their own catalogs, and they had their own I can't think of the way of putting the price in. But it wouldn't be the real price. They'd have their codes, I could say.
They'd have their codes so that you could sell them wholesale, and then they could mark them up later.
Yeah, yeah.
There you go. I just realized we are way overdue for a break, so I'm going to take it right now. If you want to call and share your memories of the Fromm brothers, I think we've got room to squeeze in one more phone call at 261-6371 or 1-800-780-9742. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. Our guests, Gary Mason and Stan Pufall, and also Robert Check, who are all associated one way or another with the Fromm brothers fur business, which really made Merrill, Wisconsin, the center of the fur industry. And Gary, you were just saying that at one time the Fromm brothers football team played the Green Bay Packers. What was that all about?
Well, the Packers were kind of a startup then, and they would go around playing like a sandlot football. They were pros. They didn't make much money, but they went around and played anybody that they could. And the Fromms had a team. And so they played in Merrill, and we have a bulletin that was published in the paper, or I'm not sure where it came from, but announcing that they played, and the Packers did win, though.
The Packers did win.
Yes.
One of the few things that the Fromm brothers weren't successful at.
That's correct.
Very quickly, the Chicago World's Fair, they had a booth set up down there. That was a huge undertaking for them in the early 30s.
Yes. In 1934, the City of Industry, it was the World's Fair. They set up a booth, and the booth was, to start out, was going to cost them $44,000. And it wound up costing them $100,000. And what it had a stage on it that would rotate. And they would have on the one side of it live fox and models on the other side wearing the coats. And they would bring live fox down to Chicago daily, so they had fresh stock down there at all times.
Wow. The Fromm brothers, the fact that they are no longer here, no longer in business, Robert Check, it's kind of bittersweet, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
How do you feel about their legacy?
Well, I think it was, first of all, I grew up in that era, and my dad worked for him, like I said, you know, all his life, and during the Depression and all, he had a job, and a lot of people didn't. And our family was real thankful for that part of it because it worked out really good for our family.
You bet. Stan Pufall, very quickly, your reflections on their legacy. We are running out of time here.
Well, I think they really left a legacy it's anything is possible, and the man overcoming adversity. It's a great legacy to be, to leave behind, and heritage.
And Gary, you've got the last word here.
The last word is, it's a great inspiration. I look at that and I actually get goosebumps telling the story of how they started and they persevered, and the obstacles, they took those and they learned from them.
And that's something we should all do. Gary Mason, Stan Pufall, and Robert Check. Now, if you want to find out more about the Foxtail and Silver Fox Retreat, you can check out also the history of the Fromm Brothers Farm, and you can do it at this website, foxtail.org or fromhistory.org. And a reminder that the Fromm Brothers History, Bright with Silver by Catherine Pinkerton, has been reissued. It is available at Yankee Books in downtown Wausau. I'm Glenn Moberg. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, our on-air producer, Mary Baldwin, John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. You can follow our adventures on Route 51 on both Facebook and Twitter. Next Thursday, Route 51 revisits the never-forgotten Honor Flight story. As you have no doubt heard, the 103 Central Wisconsin World War II vets are back from Washington, D.C. We will hear their stories next week. Thanks again for riding with us today. Until next week, we're heading out of town.